Ladies and gentlemen, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome back to the Solaria Report Patrick Wood, who recently joined us for an interview on technocracy. If you look at the best books for the last several years, you'll see one of his books on technocracy. He is the editor and publisher of Technocracy News and Trends at technocracy.news. I recommend it strongly to you. There is a great deal of information about technocracy. And if you haven't listened to our first interview, you absolutely have to do it. You have to check out his website. And again, if I strongly recommend his books on technocracy, I think it will help you see the way AI software and systems is being used to micromanage and replace markets and democracy in a trend that we don't want to let continue. Anyway, so Patrick, welcome to the Solaria Report. We're here to talk about Opportunity Zones, something I very much have wanted to talk about on the Solaria Report. And when I found out you were deep diving Opportunity Zones, I said, this is fantastic.
Well, I thank you, Catherine, for that. I want to say how much I appreciate the area that you're coming from, because my background going back for 45 years is economics and business. And I wrote extensively about economic issues over the years. And quite frankly, for most people, it's a boring thing to write about, right? It's the economy. Who needs it?
Right.
This has been my specialty ever since I started writing. And even when we wrote Trilaterals Over Washington back in the 1970s, it was primarily a book about the economic takeover of our country. And So today, very few people recognize or give assent to the economic aspect of technocracy. But this is the only reason I'm interested in technocracy in the first place, is that it's about the economy. It's about trying to transform the economy out of free enterprise and capitalism into this new Green New Deal type economy that cannot possibly work. Not in 10,000 years will it ever work.
Well, it's total control by micromanagement through AI and software. And the thing that makes it go is the federal regulation and the federal credit to subsidize it.
Yes.
But it's phenomenally wasteful. But it's unbelievably profitable for the top people.
It is. The very, very top will accumulate wealth and concentrate wealth like never before in history. It's already happening. It's been happening for a
while.
Accelerating today.
Yeah, but there's a lot more to go, Patrick, and that's part of what you've nailed. Yeah.
Yes, there's a few resources out there yet that they don't have control of, but they're going for them right now.
Yeah, it's hard for people to fathom the extent to which they think they can harvest everything. I was at the Aspen Institute 2 years ago, and I had dealt on a panel. Ed Griffin was there. It was wonderful. And I had dealt on a panel with a billionaire venture capitalist. Ooh. So I tried to engage with him afterwards, and he looked at me with these like stoned eyes. And he said, he was a software developer. He said, look, I can automate every job in America, and that's exactly what we're going to do, and there's nothing you can do to stop us. Wow. He had that look in his face like, I've been up in the UFO, honey, and I'm telling you how it is. And you know, but basically what he was saying was we can insert ourselves with software and AI into every process in the country and harvest 100%.
That's right. And that is the technocrat mindset, by the way. So you hit it the nail on the head. This is the technocrat mindset, that technology has a solution for every conceivable problem that mankind has.
Right. And can automate every conceivable. Right. And, part of this is the transhumanism. They think they can insert digital technology into humans and integrate, you know, digital systems with biological systems.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So tell us about Opportunity Zones. I can't wait.
Oh boy. Well, I probably would not have taken a second look at Opportunity Zones, except that I just smelled a rat. Don't you love Patrick Henry? He was the guy who coined the phrase, I smell a rat. He's my favorite founding father, by the way.
This is a big rat, stinking rat.
You know, I started to look into it. And at first, it was, you know, I as you run across the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, which was supposed to be the big windfall tax cut for Americans across the board, especially the middle class who desperately need it. I never really examined that act. I didn't get it and read it, and because I'm not a tax guy, frankly, that stuff drives me crazy. But when I saw that in 2018, December 12, that the president had executed an executive order called the Executive Order on Establishing the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council, I thought, what is that? What's this all about? And I read that EO, and it's all about opportunity zones. And I thought, that's strange. Now, Congress passed an act, the Tax Act. Why do we need an executive order to support or somehow to streamline that process? Well, it wasn't streamlining anything to do with you and me, probably. Well, I don't know where you are in the socioeconomic status, but it certainly doesn't address me. But as I studied this and looked at it, the president has pulled out all the federal stops to allow these opportunity zones to flourish.
Right.
And what the tax law actually did, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, it created this system called opportunity zones where the governors of each state would designate areas in their state, up to 25% of their low income areas in the state, can be designated. They qualify. It's all self-certified. There's no checking anywhere. They just send the zones designations to the Treasury. The Treasury rubber stamps them, and that's basically it.
Right. So I'm going to mention in the subscriber links, you will find a link to the government website that will give you a list by census tract of the opportunity zones and will map them so you can look in the map. And I should just point out, in my county in Tennessee, our county seat is a portion of our county seat, the biggest portion of our county seat is mapped as an opportunity zone.
Yes. So the idea behind the opportunity zone is that somebody that has locked in capital gains, like maybe they bought an asset 30 years ago or they inherited something and it has extremely low cost base and they want to sell it. A lot of people are put off by selling assets like this because it plays horrible games with your income tax. And if you have a really large capital gains, well, it can push you into the maximum tax bracket, boom, and you'll end up paying a ton of money to unlock that asset that was in whatever it was, stocks or real estate, doesn't matter.
Right. So can I just mention one thing? One of the problems with that tax is when you dig in and look at a lot of their increase, it's really just inflation and currency debasement. Yes. So if they're going to get a real return and stay ahead of inflation and beat inflation, which is part of staying in the top 1%, you need to come up with a return that beats inflation, and that means avoiding the tax.
That's exactly right. And of course, they get that. They get it. They have the ability to lobby Congress and do things that you and I simply can't do. But when I discovered, okay, this is a tax dodge, basically, people with income that they're worried about, you know, paying income tax. They've got a huge capital gain tax staring them in the face. What better way to solve everybody's problem if they could just simply sell their asset, take the proceeds, and invest it anywhere in these opportunity zones, and have all the taxes that are normally be due deferred at least for 6 years, and in some cases permanently. So I thought, well, that's a sweet little deal. Then I started looking into, well, where did this idea come from? Somebody had to come up with it. Was it a congressman, a senator? Who was it? It led me back on the trail to an organization called the Economic Innovation Group, EIG. Again, that's a boring name. You know, okay, Economic Innovation Group. What's that? Well, come to find out, this is the organization that originally came up with the whole idea. They readily admitted.
So I'm going to take it back longer, because if you read my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, You can take it back to the person who came up with place-based development of this kind, at least defining the capital gains opportunity.
Yes.
Was me. So I had a company and we were doing the financial advisory work for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And what I identified, and I did all the prototyping, took the numbers, worked with OMB and the Brookings Institution to prove that the number one capital gains opportunity in America was swinging in new technology into places, reengineering how the government investment worked. I didn't know about the ability to dramatically lower the energy price, but that's one thing I want to talk with you about because I think that's part of it.
Right.
And I was able, I had built relational databases that showed, would allow you to simulate what the, you know, what could be done economically. And the capital gains opportunity was the number one capital gains opportunity in America. It was particularly strong in the low-income areas. And, you know, so it was basically new technology plus reengineering the government money, you know, and I took it to the pension funds. And they said to me, oh, my God, you know, we can save America and make the pension fund targets. That was in that was the summer of 1997 at Safeguard Scientifics. Now, that year, the Department of Justice seized our offices, stole all of our software tools that would allow you to look at federal investment by county and congressional district, so by place. And when it took me 6 years to get those databases back out from the courts. And when I finally got them, they were the most valuable pieces were gone forever.
Yeah. Wow.
So they've been looking at the real estate capital gains opportunity in these neighborhoods for a long, long time, Patrick. They've known it's there.
Yes. And
right. So
I've heard, I actually talked to my CPA about, you know, the tax law surrounding this and stuff. And the very first thing she came up with, which is very common in the agricultural industry, by the way, where I came from, is the exchange program where you can exchange assets without having capital gains being incurred. And it was very common when buying and selling farmland, that you would seek to find an exchange rather than just selling property outright and then buying another piece of property so that you could avoid paying the capital gains tax. But yeah, so, you're absolutely right. This is something that the idea has been the concept has been floating around for a long time.
So they know that all the farmers are hitting retirement age and need to liquefy their estates. So there is a big push on to capture the farmland. And one of my questions to you is going to be, to what extent are they placing these opportunity zones in places where they want to pick up big pieces of farmland?
That's a good point. There is a lot of rural areas that have been defined within the opportunity zone map. And you mentioned the interactive map that's on the Treasury website. That's a great place to find them. There's a lot of them. So in any case, drilling down into it, what we find is a paper that was generated by this EIG group back in 2015. It was called Unlocking Private Capital to Facilitate Economic Growth in Distressed Areas. And that basically says nothing in the title. And you read it, it doesn't really say much other than what we've been talking about already. But what happened as a result of this article is that two bills were introduced, one in the House, one in the Senate. And the ones that were introduced into the Senate were co-sponsored by a Democrat and Republican. The first Democrat sponsor was Senator Cory Booker, Mr. Green New Deal. It's like, okay, that's a warning sign. Why would he be interested in this? And it was called the Investing in Opportunity Act, and it failed. It was in the 115th Congress. It failed, got stuck in committee, and it stayed there. And then along comes the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. And lo and behold, they were able to kind of lift that text out and throw it right into the Tax Cut Act. And it survived. It found its way into law. And the president then signed that. But if you go in and look at the legislation, you know, what it actually says, it says very clear what the intent is with opportunity zones. But here's the kicker. The people who founded EIG, this always interests me, who founded the Economic Innovation Group was none other than Sean Parker. People don't recognize Sean Parker very quickly. That's not Peter Parker of Spider-Man. This is not his father or anything like that either. Sean Parker was the co-founder of Facebook.
Well, Sean Parker got famous because he said, I'm going to live to 145. You know, I built something that was designed to addict your children, and I'm going to live to 145 because I'm a billionaire as a result.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people connected it to the what was going on in Silicon Valley about buying children's blood.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah. But it was kind of a very gruesome moment and put Sean Parker on the map.
Yes. And I'll say good luck to him on that count. I don't think he's going to make it. But in the meantime, just so people understand who Sean Parker is, this is the guy who founded Napster. Well, he's co-founded Napster back, when was it? Just before year 2000, I believe. He was 18 years old at the time. And Napster was that music sharing service that ripped off music from creators and simply just gave them free over the internet. Finally got shut down. And there was such a big stink over Napster back then. I remember it was just, there were people who were just absolutely outraged, especially the artists who were creating music, hoping to sell records and stuff. But in any case, at age 25, Parker joined Mark Zuckerberg. This is in 2004. And Facebook was only 5 months old at the time, and he's credited as being the guy who convinced Zuckerberg, if you could believe this, that Facebook was going to amount to something really big someday. You think? Yeah. Well, I guess Zuckerberg didn't have as much confidence as Parker did, but he did. And so they went forward, and Sean Parker served as the first president of Facebook. Well, yes, the rest is history. He became filthy, stinking rich. He's a multi-billionaire today. And he's involved in all sorts of things around the world.
So can I just mention one thing back to opportunity zones?
Yes.
When I was working on the place-based optimization, the capital gains opportunity, the question is, how do we swing in jobs? Well, if you look at, we did a prototype, a company that was a data servicing, because the government was watching absolutely exploding data servicing requirements. And the question for them was, how could they, you know, pay for all this data servicing? So I put one of my best teams on researching where the data servicing demand's coming from, corporate and government, who has them and why. And they came back and they said, the demand was exploding. And they said the number one demand for data servicing was the government to maintain files on the U.S. citizens. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, how in the world are we ever going to be able to justify hundreds of billions of dollars to collect and maintain files on all of us? In the meantime, my chief financial officer was lobbying me to get a personnel system in place, and I refused. I said, I'm not spending any more money on corporate software. And so we came up with a compromise. We would create an HTML. We would require all of our employees to learn HTML. And that year, for the year-end bonus system, we would have them create their own file on the internet, and we just stitch them all together, and that would be our personnel file. But we would have them update and maintain and service the file. And so when Facebook came out, I said, oh, this is simple. They're going to solve the problem the same way I solved the problem. They're going to have everybody update and maintain their own database. And during the time that Facebook was raising money privately, I would have investors come to me and say, oh, we have this from the highest level of insiders. This is a rigged deal. This will succeed. All we need to do is put money in, and, you know, we're guaranteed a double.
Wow.
Anyway, so sorry, I'm interrupting you too much. So continue.
Yeah, well, the Founder Circle webpage on EIG's website lists all the kind of the co-founders that I take this to mean the founding members, not the co-founders per se, but the founding members of the group. And in every case, I think I've listed here five, six, looks like six, other than Parker himself. every single one of them is up to their eyeballs in venture capital in Silicon Valley. Every single one. The founder of SV Angel, which is one of the most well-known venture capital groups in Silicon Valley, is in the founder's circle. You've got the guy who was general counsel of Facebook from 2008 to 2013. He's listed in here. All of them, every single one of them, is a venture capitalist. These people don't rep, and I might add, venture capitalists into the high tech world. They're not, they don't deal with anything other than high tech,
right?
High tech industry. So the question comes up, what are these people up to? The fast moving money that where the billions are made in a matter of months or years, what interest could they possibly have in low income communities around America? There's no money.
Well, first of all, they all have mammoth capital gains.
Yes, they all, that's point number one. They are all locked into securities that they acquired for next to nothing and now are worth billions. And these venture capitalists know where all that money is because they created it in the first place. So they know where the money's locked up collectively. And so one estimate that came out of this this whole thing is that there could be as much as $6 trillion in capital unlocked all of a sudden by this act that these people could then turn around and throw into these low-income communities.
Well, you're talking about money that's been technically earned legally.
Yes.
So there's a lot more sitting offshore. I mean, we had both the bailouts and we had $21 trillion missing from the U.S. government.
Yes.
So there's $50 trillion or more, theoretically, that is also available.
It could be. You're absolutely right. It could be. Because I don't remember specifying specifically where the capital gains needed to come from. You know, it's like, you know, things that have not been recorded on somebody's income tax for the last 5 years could all of a sudden mysteriously appear and say, I'm selling my asset.
I have to remind you of the great words of Ricky Ross. Do you know who Ricky Ross was?
I don't remember that.
Ricky Ross was the lead African-American drug dealer in South Central L.A.
Yes, yes,
who
yes.
got to know Gary Webb when he wrote Dark Alliance. Right. And Ricky Ross, when his business exploded, was literally keeping piles, bundles of millions of dollars in cash under his bed. And finally, he said to his contact from one of the intelligence agencies, I don't know what to do with all this cash. And they looked at him and they said, you don't know? Real estate.
Yep. Okay. So now you have all of these venture capitalists that are living in the fast lane that know where all the trillions of dollars are and where all the big chunks of money are sitting. All of a sudden, they're setting their crosshairs on the low-income communities across America.
Right.
The question that comes up in my mind, what has happened in just historically, what has happened whenever bucketfuls of money are poured into low-income communities without any check or balance whatsoever? I have not yet seen a case where it ended up well for that community. And you end up with dislocations that maybe were unintended, but nevertheless, you end up with dislocations that were not foreseen. And the people of the community end up getting hosed out of their community or shoved out of their community. And the way things are going today, you know, you see all the homeless population on the street in Los Angeles, for instance, is turned into a banana republic, it seems like. And you look at what's happening there and you say, where did these homeless people come from? Are they just breeding by themselves or something? No.
Actually, they're not. I've studied what's going on in Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. There's a wonderful video, I don't know if you've seen it, called Seattle is Dying.
Oh, yes.
And what it explains is these are not homeless. I used to be on the board of the New York City Food Bank and worked a lot with the homeless people in New York and have spent a lot of time sort of trying to understand homelessness and do something about it. But these are not homeless populations in the traditional definition. Mm-hmm. These populations are drug addicted populations. Yeah. They all have Obama plan phones that are paid for by the government.
Yeah.
they can call 911 for free. They have to watch advertising to text and phone, but if mm-hmm. they do, they can do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And they are being used as a weapon of gentrification.
Yep.
And you just had the federal government, I don't understand the details, but they passed a law. The mayor of Santa Cruz suddenly had a huge, you know, they just landed like an invading army and grew, took up the whole, this whole area in the downtown Santa Cruz of town land. The feds have passed a law that says the local government can't remove them.
Yes. Yes. It's a big problem.
So, yeah, so these are, this is the new gentrification wave.
Yes, I agree. It is. And we have quite a sizable homeless population here in the Phoenix area. Maybe not as bad as Los Angeles, but it's pretty severe. And a lot of people that drop out for whatever reason, they get dropped out of society. It's unfortunate. But many of those people, when they fall into the gutter, so to speak, they also fall into the drug culture.
Right. And
find themselves addicted to various substances and stuff, and their life really goes downhill from there. But once you're trapped into that mode, it's almost impossible to get out, very difficult to get out unless you find a...
Well, but here's what's interesting. If you look at how much money we're spending on municipal services to deal with that population, right. It would be cheaper to help that population than to continue to manage them, because they're committing multiple felonies, but they're not being arrested or institutionalized.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons I know there's an agenda here. And,
right.
you know, so this is not an economic issue as to why we're not helping those folks. I mean, this is, to me, this is engineered failure.
That's what it's resulted in.
Right.
Exactly. Well, you know, as I looked at the whole issue of opportunity zones, it's opportunities for the uber rich, not for the people who are in those zones, bottom line. And in some cases, the governors of the states are defining areas that have nothing to do with poverty zones whatsoever. Absolutely, you know, you think they would just, oh, well, just follow the guidelines that the Treasury puts out. But here in Arizona, we have a huge development area down actually close to where I live in Mesa, Arizona. There's a regional airport down here that's being converted into what's known as an inland port, where FedEx and UPS and Amazon Prime will fly out of to deliver to, you know, make one day deliveries down into Mexico and Central America. They'll actually have customs stations up in the airport up here. That's going to be a huge industrial complex before it's done. But the various countries will have their own inspectors and so on to certify that what is going south, you know, meets custom duties or responsibility, whatever. And this is going to be a huge venture. Well, it's always been, for as long as I've ever been in Arizona, where this airport is built is just bare ground. There's nobody living there. There's no houses, no housing developments, nothing. It's just tumbleweeds. And in some cases, it's so dry, there's not even tumbleweeds. Well, our governor here in Arizona, who I believe is a Class A1 globalist, has declared this entire airport region as an opportunity zone. and it's just waiting for development. It's waiting for people to come out and start building warehouses and offices and whatever to, infrastructure to build this area up to be a huge center for distribution, overnight distribution of goods from America into South America or Central America and into Mexico. This has been a juicy plum on Amazon's plate for a long time. They wanted to be able to deliver into these other countries just like they deliver in the United States today. Well, now they're going to be able to do it. And the people who are looking at this, the investors that would be coming into this opportunity zone, would not be investing at all in any low-income venture. They would be simply investing into the latest and greatest piece of the global supply chain that will make them, again, filthy, stinking rich, even more so.
Right.
So it hasn't all even been genuine true to the low-income communities. But still, the cities, which is interesting, the cities themselves that contain these opportunity zones are not in control nor are they in any kind of oversight mode on how this money would be used in their city.
Really?
Other than
local zoning doesn't apply?
Other than the existing laws that they have, like local zoning and building codes and stuff like that, yes, those still apply. But there's no particular, say, direction of how spending will take place.
So here's the thing. If you and I were to pick a place and you and I were to say, okay, if we wanted to, you know, really improve the economy of that place, mm-hmm. I dare say most of the best investments we would find would be helping the young people in that place be successful, including starting businesses.
Yes.
So we would want to get rid of the student loan. We'd want to make deals. You know, we'll pay off your student loans if you stay here and start a business on Main Street. We want to pick out the top 10% of the really go-getting young people and say, we'll finance you starting a business here, including ones that apply new technology, so you don't go off to the city or you don't go off to the military. Mm-hmm. And I dare say a lot of our investments would be based on, you know, picking out or we take the best small businesses, but that didn't have the capital and we're paying 25% on their credit card to finance their business. We'd say, we're going to make an equity. We're going to put together a local pool of equity and help you guys, you know, lower your debt and build some long-term capital and really, you know, and, you know, I used to find all sorts of opportunities to collaborate and put together really sophisticated back offices to back the local small business or to do internship programs and venture capital for the kids, et cetera. Right. You know, but a lot of it would organize around the best people and the talented people. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about investing in the talented people locally. We're talking about buying up the real estate. This is all real estate.
That's right.
It's not about people.
No, it's not at all.
It's not about helping people in low-income communities succeed.
Somebody could come in, an Opportunity Zone fund could come in and say, well, we're going to build a 500-unit apartment house. Of course, that is real estate. But they could say that, and they could come in and say, okay, we're going to buy this land, and we're going to construct this big apartment complex or whatever. And that would be fully within the intent of Opportunity Zone investment. They'd get approved for it. The question is, I suppose, we don't know in any given community, but is what that community needs a 500-unit, do they really need a 500-unit apartment house that may well price half the people out of the market? And who would end up with it in the end? The city would end up with the problem in the end if it didn't work out.
Right. That used to happen a lot at HUD.
Yes.
Right. And the question is, how much in the federal mortgage insurance programs is going to be used to do some of this real estate development?
Yeah.
One of the things I've seen this all along until, you know, recently, is you keep looking at government insured or subsidized or financed deals happening in a neighborhood. And the investors are making above market returns, you know, very juicy. And all of it is being supported, financed, paid for, you know, by taxpayers who make, you know, $40,000 to $60,000 a year on average, you know, and are helping the uber rich, or, you know, some of them are just nice middle class people, make significantly above market returns. And it's all rigged politically. The reason, you know, they have access is politics, not, you know.
Right.
No, it's like those Facebook deals. And so you're continually draining the bottom of the economy to prop up, you know, the folks on the top, and you're using the federal credit to do it. And I think, you know, that's another danger here. That's just going to happen. To me, the biggest danger is, back to your work, is this is to pay people to build out technocracy to absolutely lock down and control people.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to be the Chinese social credit,
right,
drilled down into low-income communities everywhere in the country.
That's right. Let me show you one example that I have in my paper that I just published this weekend on the first documented case study of Opportunity Zone investment. It happened to be in Erie, Pennsylvania. I've never been to Erie, Pennsylvania. Only seen.
I grew up in Philadelphia. I've been to Erie, Pennsylvania.
There you go. Okay. So you probably know what this is talking about. Well, this article that I'm going to just read a couple lines out of came out of Government Technology. It's a leading blog about what's going on in government. And it says, and this is just a direct quote, it says, 8 opportunity zones throughout the city could soon see new smart city technology equipped with license plate reading cameras and facial recognition capabilities. Officials say the goal is to boost safety and spur investment. Additional security cameras, LED lighting, and free public Wi-Fi were introduced to downtown Erie in 2018. Mayor Joe Schumber, his administration, and other local officials want to bring the same technology, smart city technology, to local neighborhoods targeted for reinvestment under the Federal Opportunity Zone program. Schumber, in an interview last week, said his administration, working with the Erie Innovation District and others, quote, is working to bring secure smart city equipment and technology over the next 12 months to the 8 opportunity zones in the Erie region that have been designated by Governor Tom Wolf's office and certified by the U.S. Treasury Department.
So here's what I hear when I hear that. What I hear is we are prototyping the institution of police states and the Truman Show in places. And we've teamed up with Silicon Valley to bring in systems into your intimate space and all aspects of home and communities and prototype how we can completely own and control, but do it in a way that makes us big money on the real estate, particularly as we bring the energy price down. Mm-hmm. That's what I hear. It's the Truman Show.
Well, the big tech people that have backed this are the people producing the technology that Schumber is going to introduce into Erie, Pennsylvania.
Right. Exactly.
It's not about low-income property necessarily. It's about implementing the technology that they're famous for and that they
this is how we prototype instituting technocracy and making money on the real estate as we do.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So, you know, you never want to, when you're the leadership, you never want to go to Rome. The question is not how do we institute technocracy? The question is how do we make money instituting technocracy? Because then we can institute it. We can get, you know, a whole world of people thinking they're going to make money instituting technocracy, and we've got to sell it as cool, innovative, wonderful, you know, and basically we're building the information grid we need to replace democracy and markets with technocracy.
That's right. And the question certainly comes up as this infrastructure is implanted into these various 8,700 areas across the country. It will undoubtedly spread into other surrounding localities as well. But the question comes up, who gets the data? It's about money for sure, you know, follow the money, follow the power. But today, things have changed. Today, we say, follow the data, follow the power.
Right.
There's money and data. Some people call it the new oil of the 21st century. And so there's an explosion of data collection activity across our country, across the world, but in our country especially, it's just going like crazy right now. If this is an opportunity for the big tech players to tap into that unlimited data that you talked about earlier in this program, collecting information on every person for control in that community, then this will give them an incredible head start to get a significant piece of society under their thumb. You know, some people have suggested, well, how much are we talking about people?
Everything.
In these zones? Well, within the underadvantaged communities across America, they say, some studies say as much as 35% of the population of America already reside. That's a big part of America.
Right.
And they're going after it.
Right. So let me bring up a couple of things and come back to this point. If you asked me to come up with a list of everything the federal government could do to help low-income communities, I would come up with a list of 20 to 100 items and every one of them would be what they needed to stop doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, politicians always say, what can we do? My list is, you can stop doing the 100 things you're doing that are destroying these people or harming these people.
Yep.
So they would be all stop. And one of the things you'd stop doing is stop providing telecommunications and internet and other digital services that provide a one-way mirror that are destroying privacy.
Right.
And ensuring complete secrecy by the government. So the first thing I would do is I would convert the one-way mirror to, you know, no mirror or a two-way system or no system, or but something that that brought the balance of power back on the digital technology. Because I agree with you. Nicholas Negroponte once said at the Media Lab, he said, in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all these invisible systems that are being used to compromise or harvest, and you've got to get that balance of power right before you do anything else with systems. Now, the idea that you're going to help these neighborhoods by bringing in more systems, because what you and I know is those systems have a backdoor, and there are a variety of both intelligence agencies, private parties, and I believe foreign intelligence agencies, which are going to have complete access to all that data.
Right.
So that's why I say you're talking about the Truman Show.
That's right.
And
and collecting all the data on individuals, by the way, was one of the original core principles, the core requirements of technocracy back in 1934. They stated this very plainly, that that they needed to maintain an information file on every person, everything they consumed, and everything that was produced, 100%. They saw that need. They didn't have the technology to do it back then, but they do today.
One of the most frightening things watching the trade war with China is you have the U.S. team making a big stink about the theft of intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
But we've built with the digital technology systems in this country an infrastructure whereby the establishment is stealing 100% of small business, small proprietor intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm.
They're just stealing it.
Yeah.
You know, not to mention the games that are playing with the patent system with national security.
Yeah.
And so we're running around the world accusing other people of doing what we have, you know, which has been one of our core competencies,
yep,
which is, you know, stealing.
Yep.
Okay. So, one of the other things I wanted to mention, Patrick, was I believe that the leadership has the power to dramatically bring the energy price down. I mean, it's coming down on renewables, but they have, you know, they have fusion and other technologies. Lockheed has said they're not that far away from being able to, you know, apply fusion and other technologies. The biggest way you make money on the real estate, the way you make money on the new energy technology is on the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at the numbers of what can happen, if they take huge positions in real estate and then bring the energy price down,
mm-hmm,
I mean, you're talking about incredible wealth. And then you add the data and all the control of the data. You know, if you think they've stolen, you know, I'm always talking about a financial coup d'etat where they stole $50 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can steal so much more.
Yeah. Yeah.
The numbers are particularly glorious.
That's right. And energy, I would add, energy has been key to technocracy from day one. And energy is necessary for any conceivable economic activity to take place.
Right.
And it's a very direct relationship. The more energy is available in any economic system, the more output there will be and the more available consumption that there'll be. If you take away energy, you will cripple whatever economic activity is there to the extent that you take away the energy. And previously to now, of course, jacking price around has been the way that they've controlled energy. There was an energy crisis back in the early 1970s where the same kind of coup attempted to take place, drive up the price of energy to, you know, cause a sea change in economic activity. And it maybe backfired back then. It didn't, you know, lasted for what, 2 or 3 years. But we see, you know, the same kind of manipulation of energy today. Well, there's been technology around for some time that could solve the energy problem for most of the world.
Right.
But usually gets deep sixed by the big players shelved so that they can't bring it to market.
I always have fun when somebody tries to persuade me that climate change is real. Since we haven't needed fossil fuels for decades, you know, explain to me. Oh, Lordy. Okay, so what do we do?
Well,
got any thoughts?
That's a good question. I wish I had a better explanation of this. I'm kind of nonplussed at the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. It didn't turn out nearly what we were led to believe in the campaign of our president. And it's interesting that the Congressional Research Service just released a report that gives an assessment of the Tax Act. And yeah, I don't know how reliable that the Congressional Research Service is all the time, but because they're just people. But in that article, they say that from 2017 to 18, the estimated average corporate tax rate fell from 23.4% to 12.1%. And the individual—
Right, and if you look at the last 20 years, corporate tax contribution has been falling.
Well, yeah.
This has been going on for some time.
In the meantime, individual income taxes as a percentage of personal income fell from 9.6 to 9.2%. That's a very small drop in comparison.
Right.
So it did, overall, it looks like the Tax Act has kind of just more of the same, help the rich get richer and the poor or whatever the rest of the world, forget it. But the middle class has, for the last, it's not just under Trump, this is for going back at least to 1995, the middle class has been under a tremendous economic attack and has dwindled in not only in numbers, but also in influence in our country. And the middle class is what we used to always talk about, how wonderful it was to have a strong and robust middle class in America. And at this point, it seems like the whole American dream is just kind of crumbling right under our nose.
Well, I think that was a plan. Bush used to talk about moving all the money into tighter and righter hands. So I think this plan of centralization has been going on for quite a while. I think part of it is if you're the leadership and you're looking at building out Asia and then having to compete, that's a difficult competition because they've got the demographics and the growth rate on their side at some point. So, there are different reasons. Centralization should make the little guy more competitive, but government has been used to engineer it the other way.
Right.
And I guess my feeling is, Patrick, that I think technocracy will fail. And I'm assuming that the leadership thinks they can get it to work because so far, their ability to use sort of mind control, propaganda, entrainment, all these different technologies has been so successful. But if you look at technocracy, it is so unbelievably wasteful in terms of people's time and money. I just think it's going to end up in a huge cluster, you know what? part of it is I'm a Christian and I believe in divine intelligence. And I've seen divine intelligence and markets work together, or democratic process and divine intelligence work. And it always takes my breath away. It's like quantum productive because no one is as smart as all of us. And to me, technocracy makes people stupider and stupider and stupider. And the theory is that the AI and software can make up for that. And so far, it's taken massive amounts of federal credit to subsidize it. But I think we're looking at something which is basically psychopathic. It is not in alignment with nature. It is not in line with humans. It is not in alignment with life. It's death.
Right.
It's sort of a dead technology. And I just don't think it'll work.
There are green shoots in Europe right now, I believe. A lot of what's happening in the recent elections and with the Brexit campaign and stuff indicate to me that people are fed up with the technocratic lording over everything mentality.
Right.
And they're starting to, the people may not understand it all yet, but they're starting to push back and saying, no, we're not doing that anymore. and we're tired of this whole thing. We've had it. And
right. They, you know, it's funny. They haven't discovered the word yet. They will.
Yes.
But it is the pushback of the productive against technocracy.
Yes.
It's driving them crazy. I'll never forget being in Germany before the Brexit vote. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a very successful businessman, very intelligent, very calm, very. And I said, you know, what do you think's going to happen? And he said, I hope they vote for Brexit. And they whack the, you know, those bastards in Brussels. Yeah. And he went off. And what he was screaming about was technocracy.
Wow. Yeah, that's great.
His productivity and his business's productivity, you know, and this is a big business, was being destroyed by technocracy.
Yes.
And he was furious.
Yes.
And it's everywhere. It's all over the world.
If there's going to be one failed experiment that precedes others, it very likely will be in Los Angeles, in my view at this point. Los Angeles is such a train wreck as far as its social infrastructure is concerned. And yet the mayor of Los Angeles has decided to implement the new Green Deal there, or the Green New Deal.
And it's, oh, no.
They're putting in draconian regulations, well, he hopes to in any case, that buildings will be retrofitted. I mean, really, it's just like what AOC.
Do you know what New Green Deal is? The Real Estate Theft Act of, you know, it's all about giving the insiders the ability to get together and steal the rest of the real estate. That's all it's about.
Yes.
And it's land grab.
I would agree. But here you have a major city in America that's decided to be something like a Roman city state, I guess, that they just decide what they want to do and to heck with anybody else. But there's no way, in my opinion, there's no way with all the disgruntled California citizens already, this thrown on top of all the problems Los Angeles already has, I can see a Class A1 rebellion coming in Los Angeles to throw these bums out. And they're going to get sick of it before they decide they ever like it. And if they get sick enough, they'll end up like Europe and they say, you know what? You are out of here. You and your cronies, your buddies, all this green garbage, you're gone. And
so here's the thing.
I'm hoping for that.
I think that, you know, one of the things the establishment has done that's absolutely brilliant is keep the people who are objecting to technocracy divided and conquered into all sorts of complex, you know, political or social or cultural descriptions of what they're angry about, instead of realizing, oh, we're all angry about the same thing. This is everybody. And I think, you know, I'm a great believer. One of my favorite quotes from my pastor in Washington is, if we can face it, God can fix it. I think you have done a better job than anyone I know of helping people see, oh, we all have the same problem. You know, I'm trying to do the same thing with the money, because the money I talk about is the money that's, you know, it's everybody, because it's the taxpayer. So it's, but you have done a better job of showing how they're trying to replace markets and democracy with this crazy rule system. And it's, your work is absolutely brilliant. I know it's taken decades to put it all together and figure out a way to communicate it that's simple. And I think it's really the kind of breakthrough intelligence that can help. And so what I want to say to everyone who's listening to this call, I want you to turn around and tell 10 people about Patrick's website, about his books and his work. Figure out how you're going to support it. Can people donate to your website, or they just buy books?
Well, they certainly can. I have a Patreon account as well. It's patreon.com. Okay. /technocracy that people can get involved with a monthly pledge, and that's always appreciated. I don't care how much it is. It $1 a month, right. $2 a month, it all helps.
Absolutely. And of course, the more, you know, the people who would donate more money, they look at the people who, you know, just do, you know, if you have 1,000 people each giving $1, that really counts to them. So yes, never say it's too little. It's not. It's the, you know, part of it is the number of people. I used to, during the litigation, one of the things I discovered is, you know, Black folks are very good about giving small amounts of money, but white folks somehow didn't get the culture. And, you know, I'd be in a Black church and somebody would walk up to me and put $1 in my hand and say, you know, I'm praying for you. And what a difference it made. It was, you know, it was amazing. Bless. And you get enough of those you know, but it reminds me of, I think it was Roger Penske said, speed costs money. How fast do you want to go? I think that this is a real trim tab. If we can get, you know, people understanding this is what we're dealing with and see it clearly and share that word technocracy, yeah, it can make an enormous, enormous difference. So
it really can. And let me underscore also that back in the 1930s, when technocracy was in its heyday, and it was huge in North America and in Canada as well, the American people finally rejected technocracy outright. They said, go home, go away. We're not going to have anything to do with you. And it was a flat out rejection by the American people. And if it were not for a general awareness of what it was, it could never have been rejected in the first place. But it was rejected. And that means that if the American people rejected technocracy once upon a time, it means they can do it again, but not if they don't know what it is.
And you don't need a majority of the people on this issue. A lot of times I say you need an 80% majority to get something done in Washington. On this issue, Patrick, it's the 5 to 10% in any community or business that really are the productive people who get things done.
Yes.
You know, I go back to Edward Deming. It's always like that 5 to 10%, and they're the people who make things productive. And they are tired of being drained by the slugs, and they are tired of being drained by people manipulating the federal credit to drain them, you know, and make money in the process. So all you need is, you just need that 5 to 10%, and this can shift in amazing ways because they're the ones who get up every morning and get the trains out on time.
That's right.
And they can shift it. Exactly. So I wanted to mention one thing before we close down, and that is, I've done a lot of work on money disappearing from the federal government, but the latest thing I've been writing about is something called FASB 56, which is after the latest brouhaha about all the missing money and you know, the more attention paid to it, there was a real pushback by the people who run the federal credit. And the main part of the pushback that was supposed to be very secret was the passage of an accounting rule called FASB 56 or policy that was approved by leadership in both the House and Senate. It's not a legislative process. It's just an approval because it goes through general accounting, or it's General Accountability Office and the OMB. And it was pushed through when Kavanaugh was right in the middle of the sexcapades in Congress. So you have the shriek-o-meter turned up loud. And this policy basically, by an obscure accounting policy, changes the governance system of America. And what it says is that a secret group of people, by a secret process, without any audit or oversight or accountability, can take whatever they want for all the government agencies and 150 related agencies and make them secret and create a secret group of books, which means if you get the financial statements for the government from here on out, they're totally meaningless. Doesn't mean a thing.
Are we talking Enron expanded here?
we're talking about J.P. Madoff expanded.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Because it gives you the ability to take all the land and real estate and everything that hasn't been stolen yet, mm-hmm, and move it into private entities secretly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we can sell treasuries to the pension funds, put the money in the government, and then move that money or asset that money buys. Say we buy an asset with that money, then move the asset into a private corporation and no one will ever know. Yeah. And so you can turn the U.S. government into a complete marketing shell for treasuries and tax collection. So it sells treasuries and it collects taxes, but there are no assets. All the assets are disappearing out the back door.
Wow.
And if you look at the undocumentable adjustments from fiscal 1998 to 2015 at DOD and HUD are $21 trillion. I'll send you, we have a ton of information about it. And in fact, I'm going to send you the annual wrap up so you can see this.
Yeah, please do. This is something I want to look at.
But I'm very focused on the fact that they want to take, you know, remaining technology and real estate. And I think real estate is an important piece of this, but that's a guess. Mm-hmm. And because the opportunity zones and what you're watching involves real estate, You know, I can't tell you, you're talking about an infinite rate of return. If part of what you're doing with these opportunity zones or other plays on the real estate, like the farmland, has to do with what you're also pulling out of the back of the U.S. government.
Right. Yep. Wow.
So, well, remember, man. You know, Steve Mnuchin is the Secretary of Treasury, and, you know, people have filed lawsuits for his role as an investor. They're alleging that the investors walked off with all the good real estate by moving the real estate out of Sears before they bankrupted.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Wow.
So, you know, the question is, you know, are they going to do the same thing with the U.S. government? Big question. Okay, yeah. Patrick, before we close, I can't thank you enough for this interview, for doing your work. We're here to support you. Is there anything else we can do to help you really just spread this message everywhere?
You know, technocracy.news has everything I have to offer on this. I've ceased all my other activities from the past. I used to edit August Forecast and Review. That's gone. I'm not doing any market forecasting anymore. That's gone. I'm focusing exclusively on technocracy as far as what we're talking about here. I also created a nonprofit last year to work on all the First Amendment issues that are surrounding our movement, if you will. And it's called Citizens for Free Speech. And it's citizensforfreespeech.org as well. And people might find some interest if they're concerned about censorship, if they're concerned about the various rights that we have under the First Amendment. You know, this is an organization that I'm hoping to get some national traction with to set some of these things right, or at least to argue in favor of the things that we're supposed to have as basic rights in this country.
Give me the URL again.
It's citizensforfreespeech.org.
Citizens for Free Speech. Okay, so this week we'll go make a donation and post it. And because this is obviously an issue very near and dear to my heart. Before we close, I wanted to mention one thing perhaps for a conversation the next time. And that is, one of my questions as you watch the information systems, is this part of the prototype to prototype the cryptocurrencies they want to use to supplement or replace, you know, the current currency system?
Yes. I'll say flat out, I do believe it is. And the whole idea of blockchain technology, of course, goes way beyond just currency.
They're going to blockchain all the time and energy, human energy in a community, and see if they can't harvest it through the blockchain.
Yeah. I know. It's just tremendous. It's a tremendous new disruptive technology. We've barely seen the surface scratch, but the cryptocurrencies right now, there's a lot of, say, anarchy right now involved with it. Not only anarchists, but
we call that prototyping where I come from, Patrick. You
know, okay, right. Well, it's just it's a mess is what it is, by and large. A lot of confusion, a lot of fears. But all the central banks, including the Bank for International Settlements, as well as the IMF, they all, and the Bank of England, don't forget them, they all are launching intellectual SWAT teams to understand how they can use blockchain currency technology to completely convert the world system.
You know, I'll send you this link. I have a Salieri report on the story of Gideon, which is my favorite Bible story. And I don't know if you remember it, but in the story of Gideon, Gideon and his army succeed because the Midianites kill each other. And that's one of my predictions for technocracy. If you look at all these guys competing, you know, when you get this many people with no empathy competing to do all this stuff, you're going to get the Midianite thing. Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to duck.
That's right. Get ready to duck. And, you know, I will say too, whoever invented the idea of the black swan, you know, economic event. listen to this. Theoretically, if it's possible to have a black swan event that would take everything down, then it's also possible to have a white swan event that would shock everybody into oblivion and set some of these things right again.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Assets have no value if there's no law.
No, that's right.
So if there's no law in law and there's no law in culture, you know, guess what?
That's right.
Okay, well, Patrick, you know, I cannot recommend your work strongly enough. I think everybody who listens to this, if you want free speech, if you want the economy to work, I would say go put some gas in Patrick's tank. You know, I can't think of anything that has a higher return on investment in the market right now.
I really appreciate your support and confidence and stuff. And I hope that we can stay in touch and cover.
Absolutely. We're in cahoots. You let me know what we can do. Not only are we here to destroy technocracy, we're here to have fun doing it. And, you know, who knows, even we can make some money destroying it.
I know. That would be a novel concept. Make money.
We're willing to, you know, well, here's the thing, civilization, the biggest capital gains opportunity in America is if you could return civilization.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Well, okay, Patrick, you're great. You have a wonderful day. Okay.
Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate your time too.
Bye.